Everett Koop's death on Monday reminds us that public health matters. As Surgeon General, Koop's crusade against tobacco use was a turning point in Americans' recognition of the direct line between cigarettes, lung cancer, heart disease, and other ailments. We're going to talk about public health today. My guests are Margot Lawlich and Stephen Blakesley. Lawlich is Director of Clatsop County Public Health Department. Blakesley is Health Promotion Specialist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Margot, most of us know what health means, what health care means, and we know about doctors and medicine. So what is public health?
So public health is a population-based approach to health care. So the primary care doctor looks at the individual as the patient, and in public health, we look at the community as the patient. So when we address issues, particularly historically, we looked at what circumstances or threats arise in a community that impacts the population's health, and then how can we develop interventions to mitigate the adverse outcomes and hopefully support positive health outcomes.
And in the image you're portraying, the patient in your case is Clatsop County.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, let's start with influenza. That's something I think that most listeners can identify with. We've come through a period in which your department has issued almost weekly updates on flu in Clatsop County. Has this been a serious flu season? Where does it rank with other years?
Actually, it's been serious in some parts of the area. There are 10 regions in the United States. The Northwest region is Region 10. And it's been moderately high. We haven't had any pediatric. Actually, we've had one pediatric death in Region 10. But relative to the last few years, it had an early onset. It hit really, really hard. It hit the pediatric population. But we're on a little bit of a decline right now. In terms of the North Coast area, a couple weeks ago, we had some of the highest prevalence rates, and that's dropped significantly for the North Coast area. And there's three different things they look at. They look at presentations of influenza-like illness, so how we present to the doctor with our usual symptoms, and then those who test positive for influenza, and there's a number of different strains for that. And what we're seeing most this year, again, is the H2N3, a little bit of H1N1, not much. And H1N1 is the influenza virus that was very concerning in 2009.
So every year, it seems like there is a lot in the media about the flu outbreaks and so forth, and that and it seems like that it's always presented as though this may be the worst year in a long time, and then it's not. What's your perception on that?
So it's quite statistical. It's the only way I can say it. So what we do is we gather these specimens year after year around the globe, and we analyze that. And based upon the information that's gathered from that, prediction based upon a confidence interval is given as to what strains are going to be most prevalent and circulating in the world. And then a vaccine is developed to prevent people from acquiring that particular strain of influenza. For this year, the early efficacy rates are about 62%. So if you receive the vaccine this year, there's a 62% chance that you will be protected from getting sick from the influenza virus. So it's a bit of a gamble. Statistics are fairly accurate, and certainly we have lots of historical data to rely upon.
Well, let's move from influenza to immunization, which, Stephen, you that's sort of your field, I gather. There seems to be a national discussion about child immunizations. Some parents don't want their children immunized, and that, of course, impacts public health. Is there substance to parents' concern? And if the number of children aren't immunized, what's the impact?
I'm actually going to let Margot answer that question.
Okay.
Stephen's a bit more focused on adult immunizations right now.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah. So with children, it's a good time to ask that question because we're going through the statutorily mandated exclusion process that happens throughout Oregon every year, where on a certain day in February, no children can go to school unless they're up to date on their immunizations, unless they have religious or medical exemption. And in Oregon, religious exemption is very broad. So the challenges with immunization, the good news is that no child under any circumstances in the United States should go without being immunized if they want them, because vaccines are available at no cost, and health departments cannot charge for office visits or vaccines for those who don't have the ability to pay. So that's very good news, and that's been a policy for a long time. There are pockets of Oregon in which there are lower than threshold immunization rates because of that broad definition of religious exemption. And the fear of vaccines, the fear that vaccines can cause things like autism have been completely refuted through evidence-based research that was well-published and broadly circulated a couple years ago. We always say that those children who don't get sick either are very fortunate or they're protected by those children who do get immunized, and it creates what's called a herd immunity. And so we really rely on the greatest number of children being immunized, and our target date is up to date by 2 years of age. Unfortunately, in Clatsop County, those numbers have been going down a little bit.
And the numbers of immunized children.
Yeah, and we're trying – immunized children who are up to date by that two-year-old threshold, and we're trying to figure that out why. And again – a lot of things play into that: employment of parents, mobility of parents, being in a primary care home, having employers who allow employees to get off work to get their kids to clinics to get immunized. There are a lot of factors that can play into that.
Okay. You mentioned the word threshold,
mm-hmm.
and that's, I presume, is defined by statistics.
Yes.
What is the threshold?
Oh, that's a good question. And actually, I can't answer that right off the top of my head, but at least right now. But what we know for kids is, generally speaking, we want greater than about 84-85% of the population to be immunized, and that will create a threshold around other children. What we also know is, for example, with pertussis, that the epidemic started because we learned that adults we thought had a lifetime immunity to pertussis, whooping cough, once they acquired it, and they did not. And so they acquired pertussis, passed it on to under-immunized children or infants who had not been immunized yet. And so that slowly started this epidemic that we're now seeing of pertussis. And the vaccine is an efficacy, but it's like flu vaccine. It doesn't have 100% coverage.
So the pertussis or whooping cough epidemic persists.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
To this day.
Yeah. I mean, Washington, it's really been a concern in this last year. And we've certainly had our concerns in Oregon. And again, you can look at it in Oregon regionally because Oregon has its own regions. You know, Clatsop County, we've been very fortunate. We have had some infant deaths related to pertussis, but very few.
How many in Clatsop County?
Oh, I think in the last 5 years, I think we've had two deaths, which is too many. So we're always working with providers, and even now when we get reports of pertussis, which are reportable by law, we do a very broad, what we call broadcast fax and notification to providers, all medical providers and pharmacists in the community, to let them know that we maybe have a small outbreak going on in a particular institution, or we have more cases than usual in the community, mm-hmm. so that when they see patients, they're screening for that a little bit more carefully.
Okay.
And from the health promotion side of things right now, there's enough of a focus on it that from the state level that they're wanting all the counties to work on promoting the Tdap vaccine, which is tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. And they've made available for those who can't afford to pay free vaccines that are available at the public health clinic. And we're also we will be starting here shortly a promotion looking at perhaps some a little advertising and some articles to help inspire people, if you will, to get up to date with their Tdap vaccines, because what we really don't want to do is have adults who haven't been vaccinated getting the little most vulnerable baby sick or the elderly with it.
Now, Margaret, you made reference to Washington State. Am I right that Washington has lower childhood immunization rate than Oregon?
I don't know that exactly, and I don't know what those numbers are. I know that it's been a very serious problem, and it's interesting for us living across the river from Washington is that people migrate back and forth, and people in Washington use health care services here in Clatsop County. Mm-hmm. And so as we do not only communicable disease investigations, but actually public health preparedness planning around pandemics and larger unplanned epidemics, that we take that into consideration, that what happens in Washington doesn't just affect Washington, but it has the potential to affect surrounding communities and states.
Okay. If you just joined us, this is After Deadline, and I'm talking with Margot Lalich and Stephen Blakesley of the Clatsop County Health Department. So, Stephen, you've created walking maps of Astoria as a way to show office-bound people how they may get exercise in 15-minute, 30-minute, one-hour walks. And now you're working on a countywide trail map. Tell us about that.
So the countywide trail map is really goes beyond just the county, but we are extending from the top of the Long Beach Peninsula in Pacific County in Washington all the way down to the Nehalem Bay in Tillamook County. And we're going as far east as about Quartz Creek on Highway 26. And how that map got started was we were looking at low-cost ways for people to get out and recreate, knowing that we have a lot of natural beauty in this area. The beaches were getting utilized, the shorelines were getting utilized, but the interior just a little ways were not. And they're under many different ownerships, about eight. So like Oregon State Parks, Washington State Parks, Oregon Department of Forestry, Clatsop County, et cetera. And they all have their own websites and they have maps in various stages. And what we wanted to do was put those all on one place and make them available to basically everyone to promote the area and to promote people getting out and being more physical and enjoying our space. But also it provides a little more economic vitality as well with some business opportunities.
Is the National Park Service collaborating on this?
Yes, the National Park Service is in on this, Washington State Parks, Oregon State Parks, Warrenton Trails Association, okay, and Clatsop County. Those are the main players.
Yeah. Now, we published the maps of your downtown Astoria walking routes in the Astorian, and I went on one of these walks with you. It's very invigorating. And did you get the sense that people were paying attention to that and got out and walked?
I think some people are. I don't necessarily get a lot of feedback on that. I think it's every time I show it to somebody, they're very enthusiastic about it, and they like how it's been laid out, where it shows that you can get up from your desk and in a 15-minute break, go out and get a little bit of exercise. You can burn some calories, or it's a half an hour at lunch or a full hour at lunch, and there's different levels of aerobic strenuousness that you can choose to undertake. And what we do know is that it's really hard if you're sitting at your desk all day to leave after work and go to the gym and try to compensate for that sitting. We need to get up more frequently and move around. And so when we're at work, if we have ways to help promote that through getting up, just even going for a walk, is really beneficial to your overall health.
Gotcha. And sort of stating the obvious here, but the physiology, if you will, of exercise, one reads about its effects on aging and certainly on health in general. What are those hallmarks?
Well, that's a really big question, and there's a lot to that answer. But right away, for it helps alleviate a lot of chronic conditions, and it helps moderate a lot of those chronic conditions. For example, arthritis is the first one to come to mind. It helps It can help postpone it by keeping everything when the joint's moving freely. And if you have arthritis, it's helpful to keep everything moving, basically well lubricated, so that you are able to survive or get along with less pain, and therefore less medication. Less medication perhaps means fewer side effects. Fewer side effects means perhaps fewer other illnesses and trips to the doctor. So in public health, that's kind of how we look at it, and this it becomes this whole system.
Tell us about your department's Worksite Wellness Program.
The Worksite Wellness Program is something that I think that all the employees of the county should be particularly proud of. We've been in existence for, I think, about 5 years now, and we try to take into account what the different areas of the workforce, their work environments, and what they want to do. But we have created a wellness team that we meet on a regular basis. And I like to think that this is kind of a model for other work sites around the county. And we, by making it official and putting it into policy, we're actually able to work with our insurance provider and basically get some money back in the form of, they call it like a mini grant, but that those grant dollars then are what helps pay for the or subsidize the programs for the county employees to get out and do things. We've used those monies to subsidize yoga classes, to produce the map that we were talking about earlier, to do the bridge walk, to go swimming at the both Astoria Aquatic Center and Sunset Empire Parks and Rec Pool, and various other programs like that.
Okay. Years ago, I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal, it's probably a decade ago, about a study that linked towns or communities that had that made walking easy and linked that with level of heart disease. And there seemed to be a correlation that when there were greater walking opportunities, the heart disease incidence went down. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that specific study, but in general what we're talking about here is the built environment. And one of the aspects of the built environment that's changed in the last, say, 30 years is that walking has become more constricted, harder to do. There aren't the sidewalks. And so by reversing that, when we work with planning and architects, we are trying to create these environments where you have access through walking and public transportation, knowing that just that little bit of walking really does help helps alleviate. I'm sure, like I said, I'm not familiar with that specific study, but obviously it's going to help with any sort of heart disease.
I think we've all been in some suburbs here and there where it's quite clear that you're not supposed to walk. There's no sidewalk. There's not even a street crossing. It's kind of like you're not meant to be there.
One comment about Astoria, though, that's fascinating is having walked pretty extensively throughout Astoria, there's all these really wonderful – Astoria really was built to walk.
Yeah.
I think when people worked in the canneries, so, you know, 100 years ago, it was really designed for people that lived up on the hill. They could access the river, and there's these wonderful little trails and staircases and paths, and it's really wonderful to go out and explore those.
And then, of course, the great recent development is the Riverfront Walk, which is a great opportunity for anyone.
Absolutely, and I'm out there frequently, and it is always being utilized.
Yeah.
Great investment.
It's phenomenal. Well, let's talk for a second about the Affordable Care Act, which is playing out nationally, but it's also going to play out in this county. Margo, where does the Public Health Department come into play on this?
Well, the Affordable Care Act translates into what most Oregonians are beginning to hear about, which is called the Coordinated Care Organizations. And it is integrated approach to providing holistic care that's not just about that individual physical care and attention you receive at the doctor's office, but also more about sort of a case management approach to care, And in Oregon, it's rolling out right now with just the Oregon Health Plan population, with the potential for rolling out then to public employees in the future. And for our particular area, the coordinated care organization is called the Columbia Pacific CCO. And it's a partnership with GOBI, which represented about, I think, 17 mental health organizations in Oregon, as well as Care Oregon. So that's at the state level. At the local level, written into this bill is that there needs to be a policy board as well as a community advisory council. That community advisory council must have 51% representation from consumers of the system, which is really great. So it's a train that's moving really, really fast, and this community advisory council is still forming, although there is now a charter developed for that. And the role of this community advisory council is to conduct community health assessments and to draft a community health improvement plan that is then recommended to a regional policy board to affect health outcomes in the community. So now we've gone from the patient-doctor relationship, the patient-hospital relationship, to the community now having becoming educated and having a say about what impacts its health and what it can do at a policy level, which could relate to being a built community, or at the delivery care end of it, to affect the health of the population. So it's a lovely proposal to bring together primary care and the concept of population health into one model. So it's it looks really great on paper, but I think it's going to be 2 or 3 years before we really can measure the outcomes from that.
Right, right. Well, I opened our discussion with C. Everett Koop, who was not about being on paper. He was not about theory.
Mm-hmm.
He was really about action, and he had a tangible effect on smoking in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the extent to which you remember that period, Marco, or you can talk a little bit perhaps about where he fits in the world of public health. He was Surgeon General.
Right.
He was nominally the head of what's called the U.S. Public Health Service, I think.
Yes.
And he wore the uniform, which
yes,
no one had done in ages.
Well, the U.S. Public Health Service is actually still very much alive and well, and we see it in certain venues. I actually want to defer more to the tobacco piece to Stephen, because he's also the tobacco prevention specialist for the county, and in fact is moving through a very important policy and ordinance in the county that will have an impact on populations. So do you want to speak to that, Stephen?
Yeah, so one of the moves that we've recently done, the county commissioners have chosen to adopt a tobacco-free policy for all county properties. And the reason for doing this is that we know that we're really promoting health as opposed to saying to somebody that they can't do something. But we are saying that they can't consume tobacco on county property. And We protect people from secondhand smoke that way, and we also know that 70% of people who smoke actually want to quit, but they can't because they're addicted to it. And so by eliminating some of the places and times when they can smoke, we're actually seeing a drop in tobacco consumption. And I think everybody who has been watching this over the last 10 or 20 years will understand this when they think back to when they're flying on airplanes and there used to be a smoking section in the back. People used to be able to smoke in bars, and when that happened, they thought that there was going to be people were going to lose money. In fact, a lot of bars saw an uptick in revenues because once about 75% of the people don't smoke, so now they're able to go to a place and enjoy a cocktail or two in a smoke-free environment. So this is a great example of how public policy works to change the environment to make it more healthy, so that we're impacting all citizens regardless of their income level or where they live.
Okay. Well, I'm always interested on the show in talking to my guests about how they got into the field that they're in, because often life journeys are not a straight line. So, Margo, how did you get into public health?
Well, I have public health epidemiologists in my family, and I was fortunate to be exposed to many cultures internationally. And from a very young age, I knew I wanted to work in public health because I wanted to impact the health of people in different parts of the world. I couldn't articulate it at that time. So I took a bit of a convoluted route, and through sort of my degree journeys, through looking at really studying families cross-culturally in sociology, and then a nursing degree, and my graduate work's in public health, and it was really a love of infectious disease and communicable disease that brought me into public health, and I've kind of practiced in a number of different arenas. So,
where did you do your degree in public health?
Up at OHSU in their Master's of Public Health. And at that time, it was a partnership between the medical school and also the School of Nursing.
Where did you do your nursing degree?
I did my nursing degree 20 years ago at Clatsop and my bachelor's degree at University of Washington.
Where did you grow up, Margo?
Oh, I was born outside of the country, and I have lived all over the place because my father worked for the government. Oh. So I live in Cannon Beach now, and it's really the first place that's felt like home.
Great. Stephen, how did you find your way to public health?
A very long, kind of circuitous route.
Those are the best stories.
Yeah, 3 years ago, I think the only thing I knew what public health was getting my children immunized. I think my background is more in education and marketing, and I've always really been drawn to large challenges, and I've also always been very physically active. And when I and then the other component of how I got to public health was really, I have to say, was the this big slip in the economy, which provided me with the opportunity to
find
something new to do. Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. So here I am, and looking at this, if my mission here in this job is to create a healthier Clatsop County, that's a really great big challenge, and there's no clear path to get there, and that kind of fuels me. I really enjoy trying to solve those kinds of problems, and I'm able to apply my marketing skills and my teaching skills to this arena, and I'm passionate about it because I'm passionate about being healthy.
Terrific. We'll close on that note. This has been After Deadline. Your host, Steve Forrester. My guests have been Margo Lalich, who is director of the Clatsop County Public Health Department, and Stephen Blakesley, who is health promotion specialist, who we have just heard came to it from the field of marketing. And our sound engineer is Brett Francis, and this is a joint production of Coast Community Radio and the Daily Astorian.